Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Sorry for the late start. Last week, somebody wrote us from Oregon and was initially, what's the right word, panicked because 3 o'clock he connected with us and then didn't hear anything for a time. And then finally he did hear my usual good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. So, you know, he was calm then. But I thought that was a gentle way of telling us, why don't you start on time? And we did it this time, you know, so sorry about that. So my apologies to that Oregonian listener. And I'm glad we have listeners all over. I know we have a fairly faithful group that listen fairly regularly. We have Oregon and California, Minnesota, Connecticut. And I know that the Southern Californians like to wave to us, so I'll wave to the Drattlers there in Simi Valley. And I'll say hi to the Harrises in Connecticut, where I was born in Connecticut, as some of you know. I have been following this, we've been following this campaign, and I've come to understand that for every action, there is an equal and opposite government program. But anyway, we're getting down to the end of the wire finally. I happened to encounter a politician the other day, and I challenged him, and I said, what makes a balloon go up? He said, hot air. I said, what's holding you down? No, that never happened. Anyway, when all this is over, if it ever is, I have a terrible feeling it might not be over, that we might have a lot of messy court battles and whatever else. I don't know if it's going to come to that, but, you know, I come from Florida now, so we know about hanging chads and that sort of thing down here. I remember back in 1960, there was a claim that that election was quote-unquote stolen way back then. And then Nixon wrote a book called My Six Crises. And back then I was on the left, and we thought that Nixon's book had so many mistakes that it was his seventh crisis. But anyway, he wrote a book called My Six Crises after he lost that election. And I think also after he lost the governorship of California, too, I think he might have written it after that. In 62, he tried to make a comeback by running for governor of California, and he lost that. But anyway, the point that I wanted to make on that is that he wrote himself up as a great patriot, that he could have contested the 60 election, could have gone to court, but he chose, you know, the honorable path and just go ahead, you know, for the stability of the country, let Kennedy take office. And of course, Al Gore did the same. You may remember 8 years ago, he said, now it's time for me to go, you know, and he submitted to the, you know, what happened there. So anyway, it could come to that, but, you know, we'll see. But anyway, when this is over, I'd like to make some comments when it's over from the point of view of somebody who, an observer of world affairs and a student of the Bible, whatever, limited knowledge of both. But I'd like to make some comments about where we might be going once the decision is made. But, you know, the Bible is not a plaything like a crystal ball, like some of us maybe handled it in my younger days. I kind of almost looked at the Bible that way. Hopefully I didn't really. But a lot of times we tended to think, well, we tended to look at prophecy as almost like a crystal ball to tell us who's gonna do what, when, and so on, you know, like Nostradamus. Or some people try to look at codes in the Bible and come up with, you know, with this and that was going to happen, you know, happen that year and that year and that year, and it was all predicted, you know, Clinton was predicted and on, you know, you heard about it, the so-called Bible codes. That isn't the point of the Bible. It's not supposed to be like tea leaves, palm reading, crystal ball, to know each and every little detail of the future. But, you know, obviously there are prophecies, and they are prophecies, and they will take place. And in fact, the Bible does have history written in advance. But it's where it is. It's of critical importance to the church. When the time comes, you know, we will begin to see prophecies being fulfilled. And I think we're probably going to be living through the fulfillment of prophecies as time goes on. But we want to be careful of trying to, in effect, take the Bible and use it as a forecaster of every major event. Because for one thing, you know, we have to make sure we have the whole database involved. You know, there are a lot of scriptures about a subject at times, and you want to make sure you're evaluating all of them if you're even going to try to to apply them. And I wasn't going to say this today at all because it wasn't the subject of my talk, but I read a scripture recently that I'll read again, because I know some of you may be getting newsletters or getting information, at least you think is information, maybe misinformation, but some people are into that. And so just to kind of caution you, those of you who may be getting various, are subscribing to various services or watching or listening to various predictors of the future, I've been there, done that. But in 2 Peter, the first chapter, it says in the 20th verse, knowing this first, that no prophecy of Scripture is of any private interpretation, for prophecy never came by the will of man, but holy men of God spoke as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. So let's be careful how we do handle that material. But I don't want to deny, however, that a lot of history was predicted by the Bible in advance and then happened, and much that will yet happen is already written here in advance. And that is a fact, and that is a fact that scholars will someday have to confront. Many of them now just decide, to just not think about it. You know, I think they would be challenged now, even if they really evaluated the Bible and history and saw that many events were predicted in advance. So they just sort of, put it on the shelf, the traditional elephant in the room, the 800-pound gorilla in the room that you don't talk about. But the time will come when they will simply, all of them will have to confront the reality of many events that were prophesied that happened. And that, that's not all they'll have to confront, of course. Ultimately, they'll have to confront, Jesus Christ himself, in his reality and, the whole reality that they'll have to deal with at some point. But in the meantime, they're getting in their pot shots and their witticisms and cynicisms and whatever. So making hay, I guess, while the sun shines from their point of view, unfortunately. I want to talk today, though, about a person who himself was a prophet, although that wasn't his major role when he lived, but he did prophesy. But his major role was as a king. But as a king, he was the ancestor, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The Messiah, the ultimate ruler of the world, the Mashiach, the Christos, has to be a descendant of David. God chose that particular family, the family of David, to be the messianic line. And David was so honored, and David was an honorable man. David was a hero. He's a patriarch of the church. He's a biblical hero. He's the ancestor of Jesus Christ. There's a lot about him in the Bible. He contributed a great deal as not only a prophet, as I said, but of course as a poet, as a musician and a poet. So he was both a warrior and a poet. He was the, what do you want to call him, the Renaissance man of the modern times, of ancient times, a person who could do it all, whether, as I said, whether to command an army or to write a poem, I'd like to begin by going to the book of Hebrews. He is a member of the Faith Hall of Fame. He is a heroic figure of faith. And one of the characteristics that he had was of course, faith. In Hebrews 11, the writer here comments on various biblical heroes. In my talk today, I'm entitling Kingly Character. A man with the character of a king. Kingly character, if that's a term. I guess you should say royal character, but kingly maybe is an adverb. Am I just making it up? Maybe not. Hope not. Or maybe I should, I'll just go with it. Kingly character. If I'm making it up, so be it. Advertisers do that. They make up terms. So he had kingly character. He was a king with character, and that is why God honored him and made a promise that his branch would be the messianic branch. In Hebrews 11, verse 32, and what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson. Now this is Barak, who worked with Deborah. Barak and Samson and Jephthah. Also of David and Samuel and the prophets. And then he goes on to show the kind of things they did. And I would say David did all these things. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. All of these things, I think, in a way, were done by David. So he was quite a biblical hero. Now, the Old Covenant times were different than New Testament times. New Covenant times, there is a difference. There are certain things that God tolerated, but then regulated. You know, he tolerated polygamy, but regulated it. He tolerated warfare, but regulated it. You know, we are as Christians, we are nonviolent and we are monogamous. And also, I would contend we are apolitical. That's certainly been my life has been apolitical, although I'm interested in it as an observer. I'd like to go to 1 Samuel and talk about David. Well, first, I want to go to 1 Samuel 13. David was a man that had a personality and character that was godly. Now, he was a man. And you have to understand that humans are human, not divine. They are not angelic. And therefore, we have to constantly, any human being has to constantly be on the alert to maintain standards. And human beings can get into situations where standards are compromised and serious mistakes can be made, and especially when one is given certain opportunity for that, a long leash, you might say. If people are given extraordinary wealth and power, they're more prone perhaps to make serious mistakes. Or on the other hand, if they're pressured very greatly, you know, deprived of a lot, then that also can tempt them to make very great mistakes. That's why in the Proverbs it says, I don't want to be too rich, I don't want to be too poor, you know, because both of them will tempt me to do wrong. So David did wrong, but he intently repented of it. He suffered for it, but he was forgiven of it in the ultimate sense, although he suffered in his human life for what he did. But he was forgiven and did not lose out on salvation as a result because of his repentance. So he also set the example in terms of repentance. But anyway, in 1 Samuel 13:14, Saul was the first king of Israel, but he failed as king. He was lacking in character, and so Samuel said, "Well, God has found someone who has the character." Now this was a prophetic utterance because he didn't know specifically at this point who was going to be, but he knew he would be anointing a new king who would have character. In 1 Samuel 13:14, "But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Eternal has sought for himself a man after his own heart." So David was a man after God's own heart. "The Eternal has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Eternal has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Eternal commanded you." The king is still subject to God's authority. The king does not become a god unto himself. Saul had made mistakes, or had begun here and continued on making a series of mistakes, or let's say another way, committed a series of sins. I'd like to go now, though, to talking about David's situation. Now, David then became a rival of Saul, and unfortunately, although David was loyal to Saul, Saul began pursuing David. He began to look at David as a rival who he should do away with. It's a very sad story. So David then became a vagabond, a refugee, but at the same time, he maintained his loyalty to Saul. So here David is treading a fine line. He's in effect an outlaw, and yet he loves his people. He's a patriot. So he's trying to protect and defend his people while at the same time trying to evade the authorities. You know, so it's a fascinating story, and that's why we have similar stories in history. We have the legend of Robin Hood. Robin Hood was supposed, let's go into some legends that parallel this to get so you'll kind of get the excitement of the story. You'll get into it. You know, we have the story of Robin Hood. Robin Hood was defending the true king of England, Richard the Lionhearted, who was off on the crusade. He's on the crusade. In fact, Robin himself had been a crusader, according to the legend. So now he comes back, and there's this usurper, John, you know, Richard's brother, who is acting as if Richard will never come back, and he's being a tyrant, and Robin Hood is now an outlaw, but at the same time he's loyal to Richard, and he's trying to maintain a certain dignity even while being an outlaw. You know, he's trying to just break the law just enough to try to ensure some kind of fairness in the country without, you know, totally disrupting the country. And he's trying to maintain a loyalty to the monarchy, but at the same time opposing the tyrant who's usurped the throne. So it's a fine line, you know. And then, of course, at the end of the story, Richard returns and his status is restored. That's the way the story goes. And then you have in modern history, modern times on TV, there was a show called A-Team about people that had been veterans, war veterans, patriots, heroes, had been accused of a crime, had to go underground, and yet at the same time, they were loyal Americans, and they were trying to do good, and they were protecting people. And because they were outside the law, they could do it in ways, unconventional ways, you know. And so again, that's a parallel to what we read here. So here's David, who's a patriot, who's loyal to Saul, but yet Saul thinks he's not. And Saul wants to kill him. So David is on the run, but at the same time, he doesn't want to overthrow Saul. No. He knows that God will deal with Saul in his time. God had anointed Saul, and God had also anointed David. But David knew that God would make the decision as to when he should take over for Saul, and that he wasn't to do it himself. And this way, he was a type of Christ. Jesus Christ came to become king of the world, but Satan right now is in charge here on earth. Now, sure, God ultimately is in charge, but he's given Satan a certain authority here. And Satan has that authority until Christ replaces him. And Christ, in effect, is waiting until that time. And when the time comes, he'll do it, but not before. And that's the same thing with David and Saul. David waited until the death of Saul. That he did not intervene and prematurely take over. Plus, he tried to do good even while being himself a fugitive. He still at the same time tried to do good. So here we are in 1 Samuel 22. David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And so now David began to gather a following around him, and it was kind of a band of rabble. And some of them were not, these were people who for one reason or another were on the wrong side of the government. And some were probably a little bit unsavory, and some were maybe just partially so, but they all gathered around David. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So these were probably generally good people, but just, a little more aggressive in terms of wanting to deal with the situation, and they gathered around David. So he became captain over them, just as, the traditional Sherwood Forest legend. But in this case, it's in the Bible. It's a true story. It's about David and what happened. So he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me." So he made sure his parents were protected, and he sent them to a Gentile territory where Saul would not necessarily be able to go and take his parents. Now, how could he do that? Well, his Ruth, his great-grandmother, was a Moabitess, so there was a certain connection there with Moab. So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now, the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold." So he would go from time to time to that cave. That was evidently a position of great security and also evidently difficult to locate. So he would go there from time to time, but he would not stay there because, God evidently wanted him to do certain things and to do certain good. And so God directed that he not stay there all the time. Verse 5, "Now the prophet Gad said to David, 'Do not stay in the stronghold, depart and go to the land of Judah.' So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth." So discussion of how David would occasionally come to this cave as a fortress, I want to go to 2 Samuel 23 and show you a very interesting episode in David's life. Now, these men who gathered around him became very loyal to him personally. He was, of course, the future king, and he was going to deliver them from the tyranny of Saul. All of them were people who had run afoul of Saul, who had become a tyrant, and now they were supporting David. So it was like, you have these situations in history where a great hero emerges, a liberator, a rebel in a sense, although he was not really a rebel, as you know. He was just trying to save his life. But anyway, they gathered around him, and they were very personally loyal to him. And these were good, as I said, these were good people who just, because of the tyranny of the times, they were considered from the Saul's point of view marginal or lawbreakers, but they really were decent people. And they came to David, but they were also people who were, you might say, rough and tough sort of people. They were not pansies by any means, They were very, rugged sort of people, and gathered around this warrior leader, David. So now I'm going to 2 Samuel 23, and here we have the mighty men of David. Verse 13. I'm sorry, I want to go to verse 14. David was then in the stronghold. Okay, he was hiding out in that area where we read about. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines were then in Bethlehem. So he couldn't just go to Bethlehem because the Philistines were there. And David said with longing, "Oh, that someone would give me a drink of the water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Now, evidently, you know, that water was really special to him. And water can be different, as you know, in different parts of the country. If you lived in Midland, you'd know what I mean. You can't drink the water there. On the other hand, there's some areas of the country where the water is probably particularly delicious to drink. I think even the water in Florida has got issues right out of the tap, you know, just because of the elements there. It's drinkable, but it's, you know, wouldn't win any awards, I guess. But the Bethlehem water, I guess, in those days was really something. And so he longed for that Bethlehem water. I mean, he'd grown up in that area. So the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines. Can you imagine this? They had such love for David. Oh, our leader, our master, our future king, you know, our liberator, our boss, you know, the head of our gang or whatever you want to call it. You know, he wants this water. We'll do it. We're macho. We're tough. So the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink it. You know, so why wouldn't he drink it? I'm skipping to verse 17. And he said, "Far be it from me, O Eternal, that I should do this. Is not the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives?" Therefore, he would not drink it. These things were done by the three mighty men. You know, it's talking about those men, but it also talks about David. He didn't want people to risk their lives to do special favors for him. So he didn't want to take this water because that would encourage others maybe to do it. You see, it's true, he could have said, "Well, just this once." But what do you mean, just this once? Then somebody else will figure, well, if he did it just this once, maybe he'll do it, you know, just this other time, and so on and so forth. So let's stop this concept that people should risk their lives just to sort of satisfy my whims. No, that's not the kind of ruler I'm going to be. I'm not going to expect people to, you know, stick their necks out for me in that sense. All right, but now notice what he did do to the water. That's why I skipped it. I want to go back. In verse 16, "Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to the Eternal." So he did make an offering of it. He honored God with it. He said, "I want to officially pour this out as an offering, not just dump it, you know, but actually pour it out as an offering." So evidently there was enough water. It wasn't like they were dying of thirst and he needed the water. He wanted that kind of water. You know, I'm sure if somebody had really needed the water, he wouldn't have just dumped it out. But this was something special. And so he reserved it as an offering. And I believe that perhaps, I haven't checked this out in recent years, but I suspect this is where the basis developed for the water pouring ceremonies of later years. The rabbis, as you know, I say this every year, the rabbis developed a tradition of water pouring ceremonies during the Festival of Tabernacles, and it became a very special occasion. And so on what basis would they have had water pouring ceremonies? Well, here we see David taken to the water of Bethlehem, a special supply of water, and taken from that water and given an offering. So that may have been the basis for the rabbinical tradition of the water offering during the feast. Now this is such an important account that it's word for word in another part of the Bible. As far, I think if you check it, it's word for word for in First Chron, or pretty much in First Chronicles 11. So it's there twice. I'd like to go back now to 1 Samuel. And we talked about David being in that stronghold and then leaving the stronghold. And he's still on the run. You know, he doesn't want to have to confront Saul and have a battle and bloodshed over him, you know. Every once in a while I go to Epcot. I live near Epcot. I have that advantage. I go to Epcot and I see a presentation on the history of the United States. My family may or may not know this, but I can never sit through that without tearing up. I'm even tearing up now. And they have this Civil War scene, and about two brothers, one wore blue and one wore gray. Well, David didn't want to be responsible for that, you know, so he didn't confront Saul in a battle. So he was running away from Saul. So in 1 Samuel 23, then they told David, saying, "Look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah." they are robbing the threshing floors. Therefore, David inquired of the Eternal, saying, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" Now he's running from Saul, but now he sees that Saul's people. This is 1 Samuel 23. Did I say 24? I apologize. It's 1 Samuel 23. I'm in 1 Samuel 23 at the beginning of the chapter. And as I said, David's running from Saul, but meantime, he's in the area where he is. There's Philistine activity against Israel. "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" And the Eternal said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah." So God actually intervened for him and told him to do it because he asked. You know, he was a warrior. His men were fighters. And he said, you know, it's not a matter that they wouldn't do this on occasion. They would. Well, this time God directed them to do it. And David's men said to him, "Look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" You know, we're already worrying about having to deal with Saul because we're outnumbered. We're not that large a force. And now you're sending us against the Philistines? They're a more powerful army than Saul's army. You know, we're going from the frying pan into the fire. What is this here? So he actually went back to God again and inquired again after the men expressed their concern. Then David inquired of the Eternal once again. And the Eternal answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into your hand." And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, struck them with a mighty blow, and took away their livestock. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. And you know what he found out, however? That even though he did that, the people, under pressure, would betray him to Saul. Because Saul was a tyrant, and he was not mentally stable. And had they not cooperated with Saul, who knows what would have happened to them. So even though David saved them, when push came to shove, they would deliver him to Saul. It's sad, but we can understand it. Look at verse 10. Then David said, "O eternal God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O eternal God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant." And the Eternal said, "He will come down." You know, you want to know the answer? I'm giving you the answer. He'll come, he'll wipe that city out if it comes to that. Then David said, "Will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Eternal said, "They will deliver you." So, you know, he saved them, but they're not going to return the favor. So David and his men, about 600, so his force is growing. David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah and went wherever they could go. So they scattered to an extent. So that maybe make it harder for them to be, all of them to be found. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he halted the expedition. So therefore the city was saved because he knew he wasn't there anymore. So that did save the city. All right, now we're going to go to another area, the wilderness of Judea, and there's a spot there as you get into the highland there. There's a hill there, and there's a more fertile area because there's a spring. There's a source of water from under the ground, and it waters the area, and so it's rather pleasant. I have been there. I have swum in this spring. It's called Ein Gedi. A Gedi is a kid, a baby goat, and Ein is a font, you know, is a spring. Well, that comes out of the ground, so it's called Ein Gedi or kids spring. chapter 24. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, "Take note, David is in the wilderness of Ein Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. And David went, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. The literal Hebrew says he went in to cover his feet. So you have to think about the imagery here. If you're wearing like a tunic or a robe, as you squat, you know, the robe kind of expands a bit, extends a bit, and so in effect your feet are covered. In other words, he was. There's various ways this is translated in the margins of Bibles, evacuating his bowels, relieving himself. You know, the euphemism in Hebrew is covering his feet. And they went from that to attending to his needs. So this is really a euphemism of a euphemism. You know, that it says, yeah. David and his men, and so he went into the cave for that purpose. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. What a coincidence. He goes into this cave to go potty, as it were. And David is back in the cave, in that same cave. Well, what would you do if you were David? You know, well, here you can get rid of Saul. This is an opportune moment. Wow. You know, you couldn't ask for better than that. Then the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Eternal said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. In other words, David did not want to do away with Saul. He didn't feel that was appropriate. He wasn't going to murder Saul and to take over the throne. That wasn't the way it, you know, it should be done. But he did, you know, give in to a certain temptation to sort of, deal with Saul in a way. He cut off a corner of his robe to in effect, maybe show Saul, what Saul had almost happened. Maybe so that Saul would realize that he shouldn't pursue David, that God was not going to honor his pursuit of David, that God would defend and protect, he would protect David. But David felt bad about doing it in a way, but he turned it into something good because it became a witness against Saul. He could tell Saul, "Look, I cut the corner of your robe. I could have killed you." Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. Now that's kind of amazing when you think about it. I mean, Saul was not stable. He was a tyrant pursuing David, and yet David still had that respect for Saul. And he said to his men, "The Eternal forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Eternal's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Eternal." So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And they had enough loyalty to David that they didn't. I'm adding that, and I'm finishing the verse now. And Saul got up from his cave and went on his way. David also, now it's amazing how Saul didn't perceive that David was doing this. That's amazing too. So it could have been a miracle, the whole thing. David arose also afterward, went out of the cave and called out to Saul, saying, "My lord the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David, so you see how respectful he is to him, even though they're, Saul's going after him. He does not call him names. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your arm'? Look this day, your eyes have seen that the Eternal delivered you today into my hand in the cave. And someone urged me to kill you, but my eyes spared you. And I said, 'I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Eternal's anointed.' Moreover, my father, see, you see the corner of your robe in my hand. So this proves that I could have killed you and I didn't. For in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my life to take it." In a way, David was a type of Christ. Christ was innocently attacked and finally was arrested and tortured and all the rest of it, though he didn't earn it. Neither did David earn this attack from Saul. "Let the Eternal judge between you and me, and let the Eternal avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you." David knew that God would deal with this matter because God had anointed Saul. God had anointed him, and God would deal with the problem. I remember one time going to Dr. Hay. It's kind of funny. I hadn't thought to tell this story, but I went to Herman Hay back around 1989, it might have been. We were working on a chronology project at the apartment of a man named John Cossey, who's a scholarly person. I think he now lives in the Pittsburgh area. That's where he's from. Anyway, we were there with some other scholarly people. I like to think of myself as a scholar anyway, so I was involved in this project. And I said to Dr. Hay, one thing that's amazing to me, how we're ever going to be able how there could ever be a Church of God in the Jewish community. I guess that was my question. How could there ever be a Church of God in the Jewish community? We've had this two millennia of this hostility to the concept of the deity of Christ. That's a very difficult concept for Jews to deal with, the deity of Christ. And so I don't see how it's possible that there could be, a Church of God in the Jewish community. And so the comment he made to me was, Abraham had that same question. How am I going to have a son? I'm 100, my wife is 90, and you're telling me we're going to have a son? Well, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Yeah. Anyway, it hasn't happened yet, but it will. But anyway, in this case, it's the same thing. He knew he was going to eventually take office. And Saul would no longer be a problem, and he would be king. He knew that would happen, but it was going to happen on God's schedule, not his. Verse 12. Let the Eternal judge between you and me, and let the Eternal avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? You know, I'm not any threat to you. I'm as much threat to you as a dead dog or a flea. Therefore, let the Eternal be judge and judge between you and me, and see and plead my case and deliver me out of your hand. So it was when David had finished speaking these words to Saul that Saul said, is this your voice, my son David? So for that moment he was moved, and his rationality returned to him and his earlier affection for David. Remember, David was married to Saul's daughter, Michal, and his best friend was Jonathan, Saul's son. You know, so he had links with the family, deep links. Wow. Is this your voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Then he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me, for when the Eternal delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? Therefore, may the Eternal reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. So even Saul himself, as the anointed of God, admits now that David will someday rule. He did at least get that statement out, that we could record it, and it's here. Not that we could record it, that it can be recorded and we can see it. Verse 21, therefore swear not to me by the Eternal that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house. And that was true. David committed himself. He would not harm Saul's descendants. And he didn't. So David swore to Saul, and Saul went home, and David and his men went up to the stronghold. You see, they were wise enough to realize that Saul was a volatile person, subject to moods, and he might turn on David again, which he did. It's sad. They departed in peace, but they still had to go their separate ways. You know, you got to be careful. You see, even if somebody, you know, makes peace with you, you still have to be careful. You have to be wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. You know, there may be times to be at peace with somebody, but that doesn't mean you don't realize that there still may be some issues that have to be dealt with. So you handle things wisely. Now we go to 1 Samuel 26, and yeah, Saul's again after him. And now they're down in the Negev area. Chapter 26, now the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is David not hiding in the hill of Hachilah opposite Jeshimon? So there were people that were tattling on David, you know. They were being loyal to the king, you could say. But it's unfortunate that their loyalty to the king meant that they were betraying this man of God. But anyway, that's what happened. Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped in the hill of Hachilah, which is opposite Jeshimon by the road. But David stayed in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul had indeed come. Let's continue on. So David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. So here again, we find a situation that would make a very good movie, you know, in a sense, where you're sort of skirting death, flirting with death, you know, like these Indiana Jones films. You come so close and somehow you survive. And we'll see that God in fact intervened so that he would survive. This is above and beyond. This is more than just a Saturday matinee, as we would say. You know, this is that God intervened so that that David was protected, as we'll see in a moment. So David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped, and David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, who was the commander. Well, I don't have to say it. It says, and Abner the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Now Saul lay within the camp with the people encamped all around him. Now sometimes any army can get overconfident, and in this case they were. I mean, after all, David was a fugitive, and David had never attacked Saul really, so they didn't necessarily feel they were in any danger. So here they were sleeping, and yet David was frankly right there where he could have done something. Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, the brother of Joab, you know, who was a general, saying, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. So David, what did he do that for? Why did he go down there? Well, we'll continue reading. So David and Abishai came to the people by night. This shows David's tremendous faith and courage that he even went down there and did that. I mean, he better safe than sorry. What's he even doing that for? But he had a reason. But he was very courageous and had great faith to even do it. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp with his spear stuck in the ground by his head, and Abner and the people lay all around him. Then Abishai said to David, here we go again, you know, you can do it, you know, they're asleep. You could get probably kill him and his general. Yeah. Then Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please, let him strike him at once with a spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. Now, by the way, this reminds me to make a comment. There are times when it seems like a situation may be just tailor-made, but at the same time, if you've got ethical problems with it, then take a moment and think it through. It may be more of just a test to see, you know, where your heart is. Sometimes a setup may be, you know, a setup to see when it seems like something's going to, you know, you should do something, but you know you know you got ethical issues. Take a moment and think about it, and it may not be what you think. It may be a matter to see whether you're going to give in to it or not. In this case, everything seems to be playing itself into David's hands, except for the fact that he knows he shouldn't do it. You know, so there you go. The bottom line is, well, no matter how easy it may seem, the answer is no, I shouldn't do it. You know, there's even a more extreme case. You know, now this is where God tells you to do it, and yet it's wrong. But you know, that's not something that's going to happen. God isn't going to tell you to sin. But Peter saw a vision. You know, and it wasn't really happening, but he saw a vision, and the vision had all these unclean animals, and the vision said, "Go eat," and he said, "No." You know that you that, and so God then explained to him what the vision was about. You know, so even in that case, he was told to eat, and he still said no. Anyway, verse 9. But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Eternal's anointed and be guiltless?" David said furthermore, as the Eternal lives, the Eternal shall strike him, and which is what happened. Or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. Really, it's all of the above, you know, in effect, that would happen. Not that it's funny, but it's all of the above. It's tragic, but that's what happened. Verse 11, the Eternal forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Eternal's anointed, but please, take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head and let us go. Oh, so there was a reason to go down there. He again wanted to illustrate to Saul and to anybody who cared to know about it and to us who read it now that he had no harm intended for Saul. So he went down there to show Saul, look, I could have hurt you and I didn't. And I have proof that I was right there next to you. I've got your spear here. I've got this jug of water. Verse 12, so David took the spear and the jug of water by Saul's head, and they got away, and no man saw or knew it or awoke. And now you're going to tell me, aw, come on, how could that happen? Well, it was indeed a miracle, as I read now, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Eternal had fallen on them. All right, so God did intervene for David. Now David went over to the other side and stood on the top of a hill afar off, a great distance being between them, but yet not so much that they couldn't hear. And I remember somebody saying when I was a boy that people's sense of hearing has actually deteriorated over the years because we've gotten used to microphones and so on. He said in the old days a person could go into a theater and a guy could get on stage and speak without a mic and people would hear. And so maybe, I'm not sure that's true or not, but it may be that in earlier times, people's had better hearing. Well, for one thing, people were tougher anyway, because if you weren't tough, you died. You died in childhood or whatever. And so maybe people were a bit sharper in their hearing, one way or the other, or maybe just the lay of the land was such he could do it. You know, sometimes the way the geography is, topography, can aid in getting your projecting your voice. Anyway, he was heard. Verse 13, now David went over to the other side and stood on the top of a hill afar off, a great distance being between them. And David called out to the people and to Abner the son of Ner, saying, Do you not answer Abner? Then Abner answered and said, Who are you calling out to the king? So David said to Abner, Are you not a man? You know, in other words, he's telling him, you let down on the job. You know, you're so, it's like nowadays the CIA or the whoever it is, the Secret Service that protect the president. Could you imagine this? How could I get so close to him? So David said to Abner, Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy your lord the king. You know, namely, you know, me and my, Abishai. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Eternal lives, you deserve to die because you have not guarded your master, the Eternal's anointed. So it was very humiliating for Abner, no doubt. And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was by his head. Yeah, I have him. Then Saul knew David's voice and said, Is that your voice, my son David? David said, It is my voice, my lord, O king. And he said, Why does my lord thus pursue his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? So once again, you know, Saul is moved, and he begins to look at David the way he once did. Now therefore, please, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Eternal has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. In other words, if this is God's doing, then we need to come before God and offer up an offering and make peace, because God is dealing with this. But if it is the children of men, may they be cursed before the Eternal. If people have caused this, then they are to be cursed, because I have not done anything, any harm to you. Now this is being very generous, because really it wasn't the fact that people talked against him. It was Saul's own hang-ups. But he's being very generous here. He's giving Saul, in effect, a way to back out of it. For they have driven me out of this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Eternal, saying, Go serve other gods. I've been driven out of my own country. I've been sent to heathen areas, pagan areas. I've been exposed to the temptation, in effect, to go into idolatry, because I've been driven out. So now, do not let my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Eternal. For the king has come out to seek a flea, as when one hunts a partridge in the mountains. You're trying to hunt me down. I read in one commentary that the way they would hunt game birds would be, they would kind of wear them out, or eventually they could pounce on them. The bird would be pursued, and the bird didn't fly that much. This kind of bird doesn't fly that much, so after a while the bird is kind of worn out, and then they can grab the bird. So that's what he's trying to chase David, wear him out, and then pounce on him like they would have with a game bird. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Oh, well, okay, at least we have this admission here. I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly. And David answered and said, Here is the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and get it. So he didn't even keep the spear. I mean, it wasn't his property. May the Eternal repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Eternal delivered you into my hand today, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Eternal's anointed. And indeed, I'm in verse 24 now, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Eternal, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. Which, of course, God did answer that prayer. But David's trouble came later because of sin in his life, but he did repent of it, but nevertheless it did bring a lot of trouble on him later in his life. But that's not now. That at this point, you know, he hadn't yet had that problem. Verse 25, Then Saul said to David, May you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. But even so, David still maintained a proper guard, a proper alertness. He still realized Saul was subject to getting hostile again. So they departed in peace. That's great. But still he understood that the problem was still there potentially. He had that much wisdom. And that's where my story ends for today. I wanted to give these accounts of David to show here was a person who was unfairly accused. He maintained a respect for authority. He retained a respect for God's plan. He worked within God's parameters. He didn't try to usurp authority where it wasn't appropriate. He had concern for those under him, where that they shouldn't unduly harm themselves on his behalf. He had concern for others around him. He did good to them, even though it inconvenienced him. Even though he was a vagabond and a fugitive, nevertheless, he intervened to protect others, even though later on they didn't return the favor to him. You know, so you see a tremendous number of the good traits of David: his faith, his courage, his respect for God and his community, his concern for other people, his concern for those working under him, his employees, you could say, or his people. All of that you could see in David, a person of kingly character. You can understand why he's written up so much in the Bible, why he's the ancestor of Jesus Christ, why he will be in the first resurrection and rule over all Israel under Christ. I'd like to go now to Acts 13. In Acts 13, we see this comment about David that I read earlier in 1 Samuel expanded upon a bit, or discussed anyway, in Acts 13 and verse 22. Paul is now giving a history of Israel, speaking in a synagogue, and he's talking about David, because David, of course, was the ancestor of Jesus Christ, and he's preparing them to hear about the Messiah, the Son of God, Jesus Christ, who's also humanly the son of David. So in Acts 13, and when he had removed him, Saul, talking about Saul, this is verse 22, he raised up for them David as king, to whom he also gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will. And then as he goes on to say, from this man's seed, according to the promise, God raised up for Israel a Savior, Jesus. So Jesus was, humanly speaking, a descendant of David. David, a man after God's own heart, who would do all his will. So may that be said of us. May we be Christian commandment keepers, those who would do all of God's will. Well, I hope this message has been helpful to those listening and those who hear it later. Enjoy the rest of the Sabbath. This is the third day of the eighth month. We're in a new month now. New moon has come. So I hope this month goes very well for everybody, and that we'll be in communication in the future. All the best to you and yours.